Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Today's the day obnoxious marketers pull out all the stops for our attention, but we're going to ignore them and talk about the jobs report, which is way more interesting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks so much for joining us on this Friday, April 1st. Overall, we had a pretty upbeat jobs report for March. The economy added 215,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate ticked up slightly, but that's because more people have entered the workforce, which sounds like optimism to me. For more on the labor force participation rate and something called the civilian labor force, we've got Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to start us off.
2.4 million. That's how many people have joined the labor force just since September, which has pushed the percentage of adults either working or actively looking for work up month after month for the first time since the recession hit.
Many Americans who've been just not part of the economic game have been coming back to work.
Labor analyst Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says this is how low unemployment and a tougher market for employers is supposed to work.
I think we're getting people that employers were maybe shunning earlier into the recovery, particularly the long-term unemployed, people who were out of work for a long time.
This is helping one group in particular to get back on payrolls, says Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics.
It appears to be lower-skilled workers, those who don't have high school diplomas, where we've seen the biggest rise in the participation rate.
Which matches up well with the kinds of jobs being added most right now. Lower-skilled positions like operating a cash register, food prep and dishwashing at restaurants, hard physical labor in construction. There's one demographic group lagging, though, and worrying Aparna Mathur at the American Enterprise Institute, women.
You see that women are less actively participating in the labor market in the ages of 25 to 54, settling for part-time jobs, perhaps because of a lack of paid family leave program in the U.S.
These prime-age women are participating at a rate nearly 15% lower than men right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For more on today's jobs numbers and the other economic news of the week, we've got Sudeep Reddy of The Wall Street Journal joining us live from our studio in Washington, D.C., and Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post from our New York studio. Sudeep and Catherine, happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
We just heard from Mitchell about the number of people coming into the labor force. But Catherine, I wonder, what stands out to you about today's jobs numbers?
Well, in addition to the higher labor force participation rate, which is very good news, we also got some good news on wages. Wages went up by a whole 7 cents in the last month, which may not sound
it
like
doesn't.
A lot. It doesn't sound like a lot, I know. But given that we've had very stagnant wage growth the last few years, you know, this was above expectations. And so that's good. You know, it suggests that maybe employers are finally willing to pay a teeny tiny bit more for their workers.
Sudeep, agree, disagree? Anything else surprise you here?
I agree. It's good that we've got wages finally climbing. They're climbing a little faster than inflation. And we're seeing enough wage growth now to avoid, I guess, a national uprising where people aren't going to go crazy that wage growth has been so weak for this long. But you don't have really happy workers yet. You don't have wages climbing fast enough to make people excited about being in the labor force. Most people are still just happy to have a job. So we're seeing the steady, moderate improvement in the labor market that we've seen for a couple of years now. But maybe that's okay, considering all the worries we had just a couple months ago.
Catherine, on this wage increase, can we expect these numbers are going to keep ticking up? Are we going to keep seeing 7 cents extra in our paychecks?
Well, I don't know about the exact number, but you know, I think the expectation from a lot of economists that I've spoken to is that, yes, we will continue to see this very modest but upward direction in terms of where wages are, in part because there have been a bunch of surveys of small and medium-sized businesses the last couple of years that keep suggesting that employers are having trouble finding workers. And then the big puzzle was, if they say that they can't find workers, why aren't they paying more for the workers that they are able to find? So maybe that's finally catching up with them, you know, that they're realizing that if they want talent, they have to be willing to pay for it, which in turn suggests that they'll continue raising wages at least a teeny tiny bit going forward.
And Sudeep, though, we also saw today that more people are entering the labor market, and I wonder what impact that could have on wages. Could that actually depress wage growth?
It's certainly going to keep wage growth pretty slow. It's undeniably good that you have more people coming into the labor force off the sidelines. We need that to keep happening, and it's a good thing when it happens and it pushes up the unemployment rate for the right reasons. That's all great, but you have millions of people now who are serving as a standby labor force. They will come in slowly as job growth continues, and they will serve to keep a lid on wage growth for the foreseeable future. So that's good for people who are coming in, but for everyone who's already in the labor force, that's probably not as good because they're just going to see continued moderate wage gains.
We've only got about a minute left here, but I want to ask a little bit about Janet Yellen this week. We had good jobs numbers. The stock market had a strong week, but Janet Yellen was more tempered in her outlook for the economy. And I wonder, Catherine, what did you hear in her statement? What's this add up to for the Fed?
Well, she expressed some concern, as she has in the past, about global risks to the U.S. economy, meaning in particular China, as well as commodity prices. She mentioned that, you know, we need to be cautious about what we're seeing in the job market. Don't get too excited, that everything kind of calls for moderation. And she also suggested that even the relatively slow path of interest rate growth that had been predicted in the past may be too ambitious, that it may be a little bit longer before we see another rate hike, you know, that we finally saw one in December after years and years and years of waiting, and that there may be cause to wait a little bit longer than previously expected for the next one, given these global risks.
Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Sudeep Reddy of The Wall Street Journal, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian.
On Wall Street today, traders were humming a feel-good tune. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oil prices fell 4% today. That's after a Saudi Arabian prince told Bloomberg the kingdom has no plans to freeze production unless Iran and the other big oil producers do the same. But it was another part of that interview that caught our attention. Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman outlined plans to build the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, which is, in essence, a state-owned investment fund, and plans to start to get out of the oil business. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Within 20 years, the deputy crown prince said, the world's largest oil exporter will no longer depend mainly on oil. Energy consultant Leo Dralis says the threat of catastrophic climate change, combined with the fall in oil prices, has made that move
imperative. They are worried about the long-term future of the oil industry, and they are so reliant on oil that they want to really reduce that reliance.
To do so, Saudi Arabia plans to grow its state-run public investment fund, which now mostly invests in domestic projects, into a global powerhouse worth more than $2 trillion. By 2020, the fund will reportedly increase its foreign investments from 5% to 50%. Michael Madwell is president of the Sovereign Wealth Fund Institute.
There's a bigger push to invest in the overseas assets and earn a return, and that investment income will help offset the fiscal deficits.
Deficits, which swelled to $98 billion last year as oil prices collapsed. To raise money for the investment fund, Saudi Arabia plans to sell shares of its state-owned oil company, Saudi Aramco, less than 5% initially. Sarah Vakshuri is a fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. She says there will be plenty of buyers, from investment banks to other oil companies.
Many people in the world want to have access or shares of the hugest oil company in the world.
Fakhshouri says Saudi Arabia could take a page from Norway, which has used its oil riches to build one of the world's most successful sovereign wealth funds. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There are a lot of reasons prescription drugs are so expensive in this country. One of them, brand name pharmaceutical companies making deals with generic companies to keep cheaper drugs off the market. It's referred to as pay for delay. And the Federal Trade Commission says the practice costs us consumers $3.5 billion each year. This week, the FTC filed a case against Endo Pharmaceuticals for deals it cut with two generic firms. They were meant to extend Endo's monopoly on several pain medications. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Pay for delay started out like this. A generic drug maker would challenge a branded company's patent in court, and in an effort to settle the suit, the brand name manufacturer would whip out the checkbook. Scott Hempel is a law professor at NYU.
Essentially, it's a deal in which the branded drug maker is paying the generic to go away instead of competing.
These sorts of deals force consumers to pay billions more for drugs. The Federal Trade Commission has fought back. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it's anti-competitive when you pay off your rivals like that. So drug makers switched strategies. Rutgers law professor Michael Carrier said instead of a big bag of cash, the branded drug company cut a different kind of deal. For example, agreeing not to develop its own generic.
The brand gets to prolong its monopoly. The generic then gets its own monopoly.
Reasonable lawyers can, and do, disagree whether non-money deals are illegal. And that's why this week's FTC case against Endo Pharmaceuticals is so important. Former FTC regulator Richard Feinstein says the case shows the Trade Commission is expanding its fight to include these deals that end up creating two monopolies.
It's a clear reaffirmation of the importance that generic competition has value. They don't want to see generics improperly impeded.
In a statement, Endo says it believes the case is without merit and intends to vigorously defend itself. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the role of the music supervisor, or at least the role I play, often includes a lot of detective work.
The hunt for great music and who holds the rights. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 107.6% to end at 17,792. The Nasdaq climbed 44.9%, finishing at 4914. The S&P 500 added 13.6% to close at 2072. For the week, the Dow was up 1.5%, the Nasdaq gained 2.9%, and the S&P rose 2.7%. We have for this April 1st a bunch of firsts today. First Solar, a global supplier of solar energy systems, off 1.4%. First Majestic Silver, a silver producer with mines in Mexico, off 0.4%. The First Marblehead Group, a refinancer of student loans, up 3%. First Cash Financial Services, which owns more than 1,200 pawn shops, down 2%. Who knew there were this many firsts? First Data Corporation, it processes retail transactions, down 2.2%. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrian Hill. Donald Trump's portfolio extends far beyond U.S. borders. Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes a look at one corner of the Trump empire, a golf course on the northeast coast of Scotland.
It's been a heck of a ride. 10 years of furious argument, protest and abuse. But at the wheel of a golf cart, Trump's Scottish Lieutenant Sarah Malone shows off the end result with pride.
Welcome to Trump International Golf Links Scotland. I'm delighted to give you a short tour of our magnificent championship golf course.
It is a spectacular course, snaking alongside a beautiful stretch of Scottish coastline, weaving through majestic sand dunes.
To the left, we can look up into the dunes. Some of those dunes are over 100 feet high, and nestled within those dunes is the 10th green.
Off the cart and standing next to the 14th hole, Miss Malone enthuses about the brilliance and vision of her boss.
Mr. Trump has an empire of thriving businesses across the globe. We're one of them. We're the jewel in the crown of his golf portfolio. I am immensely proud of what we've achieved in the northeast of Scotland.
But this is a Donald Trump enterprise. You'd hardly expect it to be completely smooth and trouble-free.
Let go of the camera before it gets damaged, sir.
This film, entitled You've Been Trumped, vividly documented the friction between the tycoon and some of his Scottish neighbours. It includes this somewhat heavy-handed arrest of the filmmaker by local police.
Stop doing that to me!
There are two sources of friction. The golf course is built on a stretch of highly protected landscape, and Trump tried to buy out some of the local residents and bulldoze them out of the way, claims local politician Martin Ford.
Having vandalised our nature conservation site, he then proceeded to abuse neighbours in public. He was rude about their properties. He was personally rude about them.
Trump said one of the residents lived like a pig in disgusting conditions.
There was a campaign of bullying and intimidation against his neighbours. Mr. Trump was the neighbour from hell, and not by accident, but by design.
Local resident David Milne says the tycoon has bullied him. His home is a former Coast Guard station, a small, squat, inconspicuous building near the golf course boundary. Trump described it as ugly and told staff to buy it and get rid of it. Milne refused to sell up and, he says, suffered as a consequence.
You'll see just beyond the fence line here, there's a line of 20, 25-foot high Sitka spruce trees. These were planted by the Trump Organisation deliberately to spoil our view.
The organisation says it's to enhance the golfers' view. Milne says they even erected a fence on part of his property.
And then sent me a bill for it.
They built a wall and expected you to pay for it?
Basically, yes.
Sound familiar?
Oh, very, very.
Not all the residents are ticked off with the golf course. Here's Caroline Taylor, who also lives on the boundary.
I don't mind it at all, and I feel that it's brought jobs into the area. And now with the oil industry, you know, we should be welcoming people bringing jobs into the area. And it's a beautiful golf course.
The Scottish Government had championed the golf course. Trump had promised a bonanza, a $1.5 billion investment, 6,000 jobs in the construction phase, and more than 1,200 permanent posts. Today, less than $150 million has been invested, and fewer than 100 people are employed on the course. A question for Sarah Malone.
You did promise thousands of jobs would be created here. Thousands of jobs have not been created here, have they?
We are partway through this investment. It's just the beginning of the story. The northeast economy is being seriously challenged with the downturn in oil and gas. We need to back tourism, and Mr. Trump has put his money where his mouth is.
His mouth has caused him problems, though. After his comments about Muslims, the Scottish Government stripped him of his role as an ambassador for Scottish business, and he's had an honorary degree here revoked. His golf course is proving divisive. Hailed by some as a triumph, by others a disaster. In Aberdeen, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Virtually every TV show has music, but in HBO's series Vinyl, the music is the story, or at least a very big part of it. It's 1970s New York. The music industry is awash in sex and drugs. Punk and disco are pushing their way onto the rock and roll scene. And amid the chaos, one record executive is trying to hold his label and his life together. Vinyl was created by Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger, among others, and HBO has sunk a pile of money into it, including a big budget for music rights. Which brings me to the guy with one of the dream jobs on the project, Randall Poster. He's what the industry calls a music supervisor, responsible for finding the right track for the right moment for the right cost. I sat down with him the other day and started by asking him about the music for the show.
Music is used in a show like Vinyl to help set the story in specific time. So, you know, you're creating the world that surrounds our characters with music of the period. And then also, as far as this show goes, using music to sort of help create a bit of the backstory for some of the characters who have been inspired by music in their lives and career.
Is there a moment or a scene in the show that we've seen so far, so up to episode 7, I guess, that really stands out to you that you're especially proud of?
I think that there are a couple of gems that I have a real attachment to at the moment. There's a song that plays at the end of episode 2 called Night Comes Down, which is by this group called the Deltinos, which I'm very proud to help excavate. Night comes down like shades of falling rain. Night
comes down like shades of falling rain. Another thing that I think is interesting about this series is that it takes you right there to the 70s in that scene, but it still seems fresh in some way. How do you do that with the music, not just make it of its time?
I mean, it's challenging because I haven't done very much television, but probably my biggest creative investment was in a show called Boardwalk Empire. And, 1920, when we first started the season, which I had to sort of really study, I became the expert, right? And sometimes I could insist on my dominion over certain things. 1973, everybody's an expert in the music of the 70s. People who were born 20 years after think of themselves as experts. And so it's an interesting navigational challenge because so many songs carry so much weight with different people. And so, we really had to mine deeply at a certain point to find some things that gave the audience a sense of discovery where really it is a really well-mined area. And so we worked very hard to try to bring the vitality of the era to the contemporary ear. Everything I do gonna be for funky
from now on, yeah. Everything I do gonna be for funky. When you are at parties with other music supervisors and they're asking you about the show, what do they ask you?
Well, that's a sort of a fantasy question because I don't really generally find myself in parties with other music supervisors. But it's been – I mean, I've heard from a bunch who I think they maybe more than anybody understand the massive work that goes into every episode. And I think maybe some of the questions that I would get in that scenario would be, how did you guys get that song? And the answer really is just that we're just – relentless and inspired by the show that I think that energy comes through, that people have been responsive to us.
And when you say you're relentless in trying to get a song, what's that mean? Paint a picture.
Well, I mean the relentless in that the first response is no, and sort of how do you work through no and get to yes. I think that owners of these catalogs and publishers and record companies, I think they appreciated the effort that we were making and they understood the task that we had in hand. And so I think they were open to trying to make it work for us within a certain scale. It's always challenging. I've worked in a year, worked on a movie that has a $100 million budget, and I've worked on a movie that had a $1 million budget. And there are constraints on both ends of the spectrum. So we do our best to get people to work within the framework.
And do you yourself have to go in search of who holds the rights? Is that part of your job or do you?
Yeah, I mean, we have people who work with us, but I would say generally that the role of the music supervisor, or at least the role I play, often includes a lot of detective work.
That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, it can be.
So you have to find the track and then you have to find the rights holders?
And figure out right. And sometimes, I mean, especially say, for instance, something like Boardwalk Empire, where it was really dormant catalog. And also where there's been now the consolidation and conglomeration of record companies, where we would have to say to people, no, you do own it. You have it. And, we would have to tell them what they did and didn't own.
And I was wondering that as a music supervisor, are people constantly slipping you demos and trying to get you?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're the modern day DJs and kingmakers in the music world.
Well, I don't know about that, but certainly, I've had airline ticketing agents sing to me. I've been slipped a lot of CDs in strange situations, but you never know where it's going to come from, really. So try to keep an open ear and an open mind.
That was Randall Poster, music supervisor for the HBO series Vinyl. We're caught in a trap. this final note, hashtag think before you tweet. Lululemon found itself in a battle with Beyonce fans this week when the athletic gear company tweeted that Beyonce's new fitness line copied Lululemon's designs. Here's what it wrote. They do say imitation is the best form of flattery. Maybe Beyonce is so crazy in love with our brand, she made her own. Beyonce fans didn't like that, to say the least, and Lululemon ended up deleting the tweet. Then there's the State Department, which was also shamed into deleting its tweet, meant to warn people about the risks of overseas travel. Not a 10 in the U.S., then not a 10 overseas, the tweet snarked. Beware of being lured into buying expensive drinks, or worse, being robbed. Hashtag spring breaking badly. Basically, the State Department was saying it thinks we're all ugly, and if someone flirts, they're probably just out for our money. Which, unsurprisingly, no one liked either. That's it. That's our show. Today, the Dow gained 107 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq climbed 44 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 added 13 points, 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Adrienne Hill. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.